purging became part of my whole binge-created brain wiring problem, such that, after I binged, my brain automatically triggered an urge to purge. If I tried not to overexercise the day after I binged, I experienced strong urges to do so. I would get anxious and feel extreme guilt until I broke down and went to the gym. Even though overexercising was difficult and on some days excruciating, the feelings I had when I didn't purge were worse. I can imagine that the urges to purge were only amplified in those who practice self-induced vomiting because the relief from guilt is so immediate. Purging became linked to binge eating because my brain developed one of those stimulus response patterns that I discussed in the previous chapter. Just as triggers produced urges to binge, binges became triggers that produced urges to purge. Binging and purging became physically linked in my brain, so that binge eating became the stimulus and the urge to purge became the response. When I took away the stimulus, binge eating, I by and large stopped having the response, the urge to purge. Since I never binged, the neural pathways that produce urges to purge never got a chance to fire. It was as if I'd put up a roadblock in my brain so that the stimulus response pattern never got set in motion. However, I noticed that it was possible for my brain to generate a desire to purge even if I had not binged. Two situations sometimes brought this about. One, the urge to purge from simple overeating. This was a situation where I was most likely to experience an urge to purge. If I ate a big meal or felt a bit too full, the feeling of fullness sometimes triggered a response similar to the response binge eating triggered. I found myself thinking, I can just work out for a long time tomorrow to burn it off. The problem was, since fullness was part of the old stimulus of binge eating, my lower brain acted as if I had actually binged whenever I felt a bit too full. For a short while after I quit binge eating, I just had to live with this. I ignored the automatic messages telling me that I needed to overexercise simply because I ate a little too much, and soon, fullness stopped producing urges to purge. 2. The urge to purge when I ate former binge foods. No food can cause purging, but certain foods, especially those I used to binge on, sometimes created urges to purge, just as they sometimes created urges to binge. Even though I ate the former binge foods in normal quantities, my lower brain sometimes reacted nonetheless. It was reacting to the quality and type of food that I ate, sugary and fattening, and not necessarily to quantity. For example, I used to binge on entire bags of potato chips. So if I ate a normal portion of potato chips, I sometimes had automatic thoughts telling me that I needed to work out more to make up for eating the chips. This doesn't mean chips were a problem or that I needed to eliminate them. It only meant that my lower brain had learned to associate eating chips with purging. Since I didn't act on my urges to purge, they soon went away. Dealing with urges to purge. I dealt with urges to purge the same way I dealt with urges to binge. I recognized the urge as neurological junk, a remnant of my old habit, separated my highest human brain from the urge, didn't react emotionally to it, and, of course, didn't act on it. I remained aware of situations that could give rise to urges to purge, but I didn't need to avoid them to learn to cope well with them. I just knew that I didn't have to do what my lower brain was urging me to do. I could veto any eating disorder-related urge, whether it was to binge, to spend many hours in the gym, or to restrict my food intake after simple overeating. The neural connections that once produced my urges to purge simply faded away with lack of use. And now I can eat a big meal without any desire to compensate for it, and I can feel normal after exercising for only 20 minutes. Purging without binge eating. Before I end this chapter, there is one more issue to address. There are some with eating disorders who do not binge, but they nevertheless purge after normal meals or even after eating a very small amount. It is common for anyone who self-induces vomiting or abuses laxatives to consider herself bulimic, but this is actually a misuse of the term. Bulimics, by definition, binge eat. When someone is purging regular meals or small amounts of food, she is engaging in a severe and dangerous form of restrictive dieting. Some have suggested that a new eating disorder, purging disorder, be added as a distinct classification. Purging without binge eating can be more complicated than bulimia or BED. I believe, for the same reasons that anorexia can be more complicated. If the woman sets out to lose weight, and that's what she is doing by purging, then she will have less motivation to quit. The purging may be ego-syntonic, in line with what her true self wants. Making it more difficult is the fact that purging can become addicting, so that any amount of food can trigger an urge to get rid of it. Furthermore, purging can lead to severe gastrointestinal problems, which can make keeping down any food painful and the urges to purge harder to resist. Once the purging habit forms, the urges to purge are the only true cause of purging. However, the woman may have a hard time separating herself from those urges if she sees them as her own true intention. Like I've stated previously, the first step in both traditional therapy and, in my opinion, is wanting to recover. Certainly, the advice I've given for resisting urges to binge and purge could apply to someone with purging disorder. But only once recovery is desired and the woman can see the urges as an unwanted intrusion in her life. The same holds for anorexia. Once the woman can see the desire to starve as something apart from her highest self, only then can she overcome the problem. Chapter 37. Coexisting Problems. Research does show a frequent correlation between bulimia and other psychiatric conditions. Those diagnosed with bulimia are often diagnosed with a coexisting problem, such as depression, anxiety, substance abuse, or personality disorders. Coexisting problems are called comorbidities by health professionals, and it's been shown that about 75% of bulimics are affected by other behavioral, emotional, or psychological problems. It's often difficult to tell if the coexisting problems are the consequences of the behavior or if they are the traits that make one more vulnerable to developing bulimia in the first place. In my case, I was diagnosed with depression and anxiety, and as I discussed, I spent much time in therapy addressing these coexisting problems, hoping that would make my urges to binge go away. Even if fixing coexisting problems could have completely eliminated my urges to binge, it still would have been a gargantuan task. I think that I may always be prone to depression and high anxiety. This doesn't mean I have to resign myself to those problems and do nothing to help myself change. It only means that if I were still waiting for my coexisting problems to go away in order to stop my habit of binge eating, I would still be waiting, because my anxiety and my depressive tendencies seem to be stubborn parts of who I am. I believe that even if I would have solved my depression and anxiety fully and completely, it would not have cured my bulimia. If I would have overcome depression, I would have overcome depression. If I would have learned to manage my anxiety well, I would have learned to manage my anxiety well. Bulimia is a separate problem with a separate cure. This is not to say there is no correlation between bulimia and coexisting problems. I believe coexisting problems can be one of three things. 1. Susceptibilities to dieting. 2. Results of bulimia. 3. Reasons bulimics don't want better for themselves. Coexisting problems as susceptibilities to dieting. Problems like depression and anxiety, if they exist prior to the development of disordered eating, can make someone more likely to diet and let that diet get out of control, which in turn can lead to the development of an eating disorder. If a young woman is depressed, she may begin restrictive dieting, thinking thinness will make her happy. If a young woman has high anxiety, she may take a simple diet too far by worrying about every calorie and every pound. If a young woman has OCD, she may be more likely to become obsessive about her eating behavior. I could theorize about how my own tendency toward high anxiety and depression played into my decision to diet, but none of it is hard fact. All that matters is that I had some susceptibilities, two of which were anxiety and depression, that made me more likely to diet and made dieting more likely to be problematic. After I binged for the first time, my high anxiety probably made me more likely to purge, setting the binge-purging cycle in motion, which led to habit formation. Coexisting problems as a result of bulimia. The coexisting problems that I experienced while I was bulimic were often consequences of the bulimia itself. It was often difficult to tell which problems were results of binge eating and which were separate problems. It was hard to remember which issues existed before the binge eating started because I looked into my past with bias. Once I learned that problems like depression and anxiety can cause eating disorders to develop, it was easy to look back and find instances of depression and anxiety in my childhood. Once bulimia developed, it only compounded whatever anxiety and depression I did have, because binge eating was a constant source of stress and sadness. Once I ended my habit and took away that source of guilt, isolation, self-hatred, and stress, much of my anxiety and depression alleviated. Even if I was more anxious or depressed than the average person before developing bulimia, and even if I am more anxious and depressed than the average person now that I am recovered, one thing is for certain. My binge eating made it so much worse. Coexisting problems as reasons bulimics don't want better for themselves. In the winter of my senior year of college, my binge eating was the worst it had ever been, and my depression increased greatly to the point that it made me apathetic toward recovery. I couldn't see a way out. I thought I would be doomed to binge for the rest of my life. I was completely exhausted, and I didn't see the point of trying anymore. I gained weight rapidly and binged continuously, sometimes for days at a time. I stopped trying to fight, which had never helped me quit in the past, but at least a fighting spirit helped me from completely folding. My depression allowed me to resign to my lower brain and let it have complete control. I didn't care what health consequences I was suffering, and some days I wasn't sure if I wanted to live anymore, let alone recover. My relationships fell by the wayside, and I felt like my life had no direction or purpose. My highest human brain temporarily gave up, and my habit completely took over. Luckily, I snapped out of this low state of mind and began trying to recover again. However, my ways of trying to recover at that time, therapy's methods, were not effective, so I continued to binge even when my severe depression lifted. With the right information, I think I could have conquered my habit even during that time of severe depression, but I think it would have been much harder to capture the power of my highest human brain when I felt so low. To stop my habit, I had to know that my true self was powerful, capable of overriding the automatic functions of my brain. Even with the right information and tactics for handling my urges to binge, my true self might have needed a little boost in the form of depression treatment, medication, or some other alternative. This was the only time during my bulimia that I could argue that treating my depression first, so that it lifted slightly, prior to stopping the habit, might have made some sense, but otherwise, it was unnecessary for recovery. What to solve first? In the majority of cases where coexisting problems are present, except when those problems are severe and incapacitating, I would argue it simply makes more sense to solve the bulimia first. It's a losing battle to try to solve problems that are the results of bulimia while continuing to indulge the habit. Furthermore, solving the bulimia is the only way to see which problems truly are separate problems and which are consequences of the bulimia itself. Bulimia and BED are usually the simplest and most clear-cut problems to solve with the most straightforward cure: stop binge eating. If some problems don't go away completely after the binge eating stops, at least the woman will be more clear-headed to tackle the conditions that remain. Or she may find that coexisting problems are not significant without the bulimia amplifying them, and thus, there is nothing left from which to recover. Chapter 38. Medication. Drugs are often used to treat anxiety, depression, and other conditions that coexist with bulimia or BED. But some drugs are prescribed specifically to treat bulimia or BED itself. Antidepressants are the most commonly prescribed, although only one antidepressant, Prozac, has been approved by the Food and Drug Administration to treat bulimia. During the course of my bulimia, I took Prozac as well as two other types of antidepressants. Serotonin. Prozac and antidepressants like it are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, which work by increasing the level of the neurotransmitter serotonin in the brain. Serotonin is associated with appetite and mood. Low serotonin levels are linked to low mood and increased appetite, and high serotonin levels are linked to elevated mood and decreased appetite. Since bulimics and those with BED show symptoms of low mood and increased appetite, they are often assumed to have low serotonin levels. Bulimics binge eat to raise their serotonin levels and therefore improve their mood, decrease stress, and alleviate depression. So, as this theory would have it, binge eating is a form of subconscious self-medication. The carbohydrate cravings, then, are a means of the brain trying to correct a chemical imbalance, in this case of serotonin. Although binge eaters may indeed have low serotonin levels, believing this theory led to two problems for me. Problem 1. False expectations for a cure. The measure of any theory or course of treatment is effectiveness. If low serotonin levels are the true cause of binge eating, then the antidepressant medications I took would have been fail-safe treatments. If I had only been binge eating to raise my serotonin levels, then increasing serotonin in my brain would have eliminated all binge eating. But antidepressants did not cure my bulimia, and they do not cure all cases of bulimia. No antidepressant, or any other psychiatric drug for that matter, has been shown to stop binge eating. Although Prozac and other types of antidepressants have been shown to lessen binging and purging in the short term and lessen depressive symptoms overall, that is not a cure. Antidepressants and other psychiatric drugs were not acting directly on my real problem, my urges to binge. No drug completely and permanently erased those urges, although Topamax temporarily reduced them greatly. No drug could undo my habit. No drug could change those faulty neuropathways that I created by binge eating over and over again. No drug could correct my binge-created brain wiring problem. Even though psychiatric drugs did indeed have a physical effect on my brain, and the antidepressants I took certainly elevated my mood, those brain changes could not cure my bulimia. Furthermore, I think I expected the drugs to provide the secondary benefits of binge eating. But a psychiatric drug can't do that. Medication didn't taste good, it didn't feel good going down, and it didn't provide instant satisfaction, distraction, or numbness. All of the things I came to crave once the binge eating was established. By expecting a pill to take away my desire for those secondary benefits, I was setting myself up for disappointment. Nothing else could provide those benefits. The hard truth was, I just had to give them up. Problem 2. The serotonin theory gave me excuses to binge. Like so many concepts and theories touted by traditional therapy, the serotonin theory of bulimia gave me excuses, two of them in particular, to keep following my urges to binge. Excuse number 1. When I'm happy and feel good, I will stop binging. I knew that the serotonin-raising antidepressants and other drugs I was prescribed were designed to improve my mood, which in turn was supposed to take away my need to binge eat. The serotonin theory promoted the harmful mindset that I needed to feel good and be happy through psychiatric drugs or other means, in order to stop binge eating. So what happened when I did not find happiness and continued to feel low? My brain used that to produce self-pitying thoughts and feelings that encouraged me to binge. When I felt low, I believed I was justified in continuing to binge eat because, after all, binging was the only thing that made me feel good and elevated my mood. At least that's what my brain told me. I knew better, and I knew any good feeling binging gave me simply wasn't worth it. What's more, there were times during my bulimia when the antidepressants were effective in elevating my mood, or when I was just happier in general, without the use of medication, but I nevertheless continued having urges to binge and continued binge eating. Maybe slightly less, but continued all the same. When this happened, I thought maybe I just wasn't happy enough. Maybe if I could feel just a little better, a little more fulfilled in my life, then I could stop binge eating. This endless quest for a higher level of happiness could have gone on indefinitely without ever stopping my habit. As I talked about in Chapter 35's discussion of triggers, binge eating can be associated with low moods and negative events more than positive ones. This is because when a woman is feeling down, she may crave something to make her feel better. And of course, if the woman is a binge eater, the first thing her brain will habitually suggest is food, lots and lots of food. So theoretically, if the woman felt down less often, say, with the help of drugs to increase her serotonin level, she may crave binge eating less often. Yes, medication can address triggers by taking away the stimulus, for example, feeling depressed and lonely, so that the response, the urge to binge, doesn't occur. However, because a bulimic's urges to binge don't occur solely in response to feelings of depression and loneliness, she will still have the urges, and if she doesn't know how to deal with them, she will still binge. Additionally, if the medication's effect wear off, or if she stops taking it, her depression and loneliness will return and her urges will again escalate. I'm glad I did not attribute my recovery to increased happiness or elevated moods, because that would put me constantly at risk for relapse. Inevitable low moods and unhappiness would automatically make me think that I needed to binge. Whether it relates to recovery or relapse, the mindset that feeling good equals a cessation of binge eating is dangerous. For me, feeling good through medication, while still binge eating, was probably more dangerous than binge eating without the mood-elevating effects of medication. The best example of this was when I was first prescribed Prozac during the second semester of my freshman year of college. After a few weeks on the medication, my mood certainly improved to the point that I was almost giddy. It felt unnatural, but I enjoyed the huge lift that the medication gave me. Although feeling better gave me a sunnier outlook on life, my elevated mood actually served to make me nonchalant about my binge eating and purging. When I binged and purged, I didn't feel very guilty. I didn't worry about it much at all. But just because I felt less guilt, shame, and stress surrounding my destructive behaviors didn't mean I stopped engaging in those behaviors. The medication was not a cure. It was also not an improvement. A blasé attitude toward the seriousness of my problem was not conducive to recovery, and it put me at risk for ignoring dangerous health consequences. Excuse number 2. It's not really my fault. I have low serotonin levels. The serotonin theory taught me that I binged for a deeper purpose. It taught me that I was using food to correct a physical defect in my brain, the lack of a specific neurotransmitter. This has set me up to blame my behavior on my neurotransmitters and avoid personal responsibility. I adopted the harmful idea that chemically caused eating is not your fault. I erroneously believed I was sick and binge eating was my medicine. Even if I did truly have low serotonin level or some other chemical imbalance in my brain, and even if I still do, binge eating is surely not a cure for that problem. If I happen to talk to a doctor about possible low serotonin levels in my brain, I guarantee he would not recommend binge eating. In any case, whatever chemicals were off balance in my brain didn't automatically propel me toward the refrigerator. I always had a choice because of my highest human brain. My individual brain chemistry may have given me tendencies to feel and act in certain ways, but all it gave me was tendencies. Although blaming my behavior on my brain chemistry allowed me to avoid responsibility, I found it infinitely more gratifying when I accepted responsibility for my behavior and chose to change it. Other drugs. I have mentioned that opiates are a factor in the pleasurable habit-forming nature of binge eating. Opiate blockers such as naloxone have been shown to decrease feeding and decrease a preference for sweets in animals. However, opiate blockers have been found to be an ineffective treatment for binge eating in humans. Likewise, drugs that block dopamine, another pleasurable brain chemical that may be involved in binge eating, are not effective in the treatment of eating disorders. Anti-epileptic drugs like Topamax have been shown to temporarily decrease or stop binge eating, but they have adverse side effects that limit their use in many eating disorder patients. Brain changes without drugs. I believe that the ineffectiveness of these drugs, those that affect serotonin, opiates, dopamine, and even multiple systems, like the anti-epileptics, show that we can't simply tweak one part of the brain or one chemical process to affect a major and lasting change. Eating is far too complex of a behavior for that. Too many brain regions, neurochemicals, and hormones are involved in eating, in the brain itself and in the peripheral nervous system. Maybe one day, as our understanding of the nervous system improves, scientists will be able to come up with a medication that fixes all the right brain and peripheral chemicals and systems completely and permanently. But if that ever occurs, what side effects will that medication have? Will all the artificial changes be worth it, just for an easy fix for a binge-created brain wiring problem? I believe that I was able to access all the right neurochemicals and brain systems that drove my habit through safe and natural behavior change. No medications required. Brain chemical imbalances as vulnerabilities. As I've said before, of course there was something different about me that made me susceptible to dieting, overly restrictive dieting, and prone to develop a habit of binge eating. Brain chemical differences certainly could have been one of those factors. Maybe some of those chemical differences caused me to enjoy dieting when I first began. Maybe some of them explain why my survival drives were so strong. Maybe some of them provide reasons for why I derived pleasure from binge eating. Why large amounts of highly palatable foods were addicting to me. Why my lower brain developed and held onto my habit. Maybe the particular makeup of my brain made me more likely to make the wrong choices when it came to dieting and binge eating. And without knowing what was going on in my brain, I followed my neurochemicals into those wrong choices. This is not my way of excusing the choices I made. I'm only saying that something surely made me susceptible to bulimia in the first place. But that didn't matter when it came to recovery. I still retain the ability to overcome my automatic brain functions. I still retain the ability to put brain over binge. Even if I did have differences or abnormalities in the makeup of my neurotransmitters, I no longer had to let it lead me into the wrong actions. My change of perspective about brain chemicals is best summed up by Dr. John J. Rady at A User's Guide to the Brain. Blaming yourself for the psychological shortcomings of your brain, whatever it may be, is misdirected energy. Energy better spent in changing your habits and lifestyle to live the most productive life you can. Chapter 39. Prevention. I often think of things that may have kept me from developing bulimia in the first place, and there is only one thing that would have prevented it, avoidance of dieting. If I could have somehow avoided dieting, I could have avoided an eating disorder. So what would have prevented me, and what will prevent other young women from dieting? Restrictive dieting is serious and potentially dangerous, especially in young people, but I don't believe the dangers are clearly communicated. Dieting is praised in our culture, and the aim to prevent it in young people isn't strong enough. I often see advertisements to discourage kids from taking drugs which are sometimes terrifying in nature. I've also seen billboards showing a ghastly figure of a drug addict. I've heard a radio commercial featuring an addict talking about all the horrible consequences he faced as a result of his drug use. Police go to high schools and put on chilling presentations about the risks of drinking and driving. None of this is done in regard to dieting. Since eating disorders are viewed as diseases like diabetes and lupus, plenty of groups like the National Eating Disorders Association raise awareness about them, just as the American Cancer Society raises awareness about cancer. It's fine to raise awareness about eating disorders, but I believe more focus should be on preventing dieting, because eating disorders are not illnesses that inexplicitly happen to people. Nearly all cases of anorexia and bulimia, and a large number of cases of BED, would never occur without the initial diet, just like a drug addiction would never occur without that first hit. There are susceptibilities to eating disorders, just like there are susceptibilities to drug addictions, but the first diet, like the first hit of a drug, is not inevitable based on those susceptibilities. It is a choice, and one that can be prevented. When parents tell their kids not to smoke, they say, "Don't smoke," and possibly inform them of the horrible consequences of smoking. They don't say, "Smoking is a disease you should be aware of." I'm not suggesting that scare tactics are the most effective way to prevent restrictive dieting, smoking, drinking and driving, or drug abuse. But there have to be measures to discourage all of these behaviors in young people. Restrictive dieting should not be excluded from the list of detrimental behaviors, and it should definitely not be praised. Prevention can be complex. I realize that "don't diet" is a more complicated message than "don't smoke," because smoking is clearly definable and dieting is not so clear-cut. Cutting back on junk foods and cutting down excessive portions is not truly dieting. It's learning to eat healthier. But even healthy improvements can have the effect of throwing the body from homeostasis and triggering survival instincts. In other words, the diet doesn't necessarily have to be restrictive to cause problems. Adolescents in a situation where they need to make changes to become healthier should be educated about survival instincts and why their bodies initially protest even healthy changes in eating habits. They should also be encouraged that soon, if they stick to it, healthy changes will become habitual and effortless. Discouraging dieting is also a tough issue in that it could send the wrong message. That is, it could encourage teens to eat excessively in the name of not dieting. Therefore, harping on adolescents' eating habits to ensure they don't diet could run the risk of making them overthink their eating and lose touch with their natural hunger and fullness cues. Because of these issues and more, I am not claiming there is an easy answer to dieting prevention, but I do think there are three things that may have helped me avoid dieting in the first place. I am not blaming any of these factors for my own choices, but I believe that the following changes may have helped me choose to keep eating naturally. Less emphasis on weight in the family. Too many young women are raised by mothers and sometimes fathers obsessed with their weight, talking about their diets and workout plans, talking about how fattening certain foods are, lamenting about parts of their bodies they consider fat. I don't need to share exact details about my own family's issues surrounding weight while I was growing up to admit that there were definitely issues. There were comments, nothing too outrageous or out of the ordinary, that led me to believe that any excess weight was not preferable, and not just for health reasons, but for personal worth. I personally believe weight and food should be discussed in a family in the context of health, not in the context of appearance. I think positive role models, both in and out of the family, could do much good in dieting prevention. More preparation for weight changes during puberty. Because my background involved believing that weight gain was bad, puberty was more worrisome than it should have been. Now, with perspective, I know that the natural weight gain I experienced in puberty would not have kept up indefinitely. My body would have leveled off at a natural weight, a woman's weight, not a child's, and it would not have escalated to me being overweight. Back then, I needed to know that the extra weight in puberty was healthy, normal, and beneficial, not only for my future childbearing years, but in the present for athletics and strength. I wish I would have welcomed the change and not deprived my body of nutrition during such a vital period of growth. Since being thin is praised so much, I think skinny girls like I was may risk fighting the change or lamenting the loss of their girlish bodies even more than others do. Knowledge of ineffectiveness of restrictive dieting. When I started dieting after my tonsillectomy, my parents recognized it soon enough. However, their main message, it seemed, was to try to convince me there was nothing to worry about, that I was thin and didn't need to lose weight. I remember asking to buy a diet book in Walmart one day, and my mom telling me that I was skinny and didn't need to diet. I'm not saying theirs was the wrong approach, and it was certainly well-meaning, but it wasn't effective. Telling me not to worry about my weight, when I'd clearly watched it go up in recent years, wasn't going to quell my concerns. The message I got was, "You are still skinny, so stop worrying about it." From this message I took away, "You better watch out, because if you don't cut back on calories, you won't be skinny anymore." I think a little validation of my feelings might have helped, as in, yes, you have gained weight in high school, yes, it's normal, yes, it's healthy, and yes, it's going to stop. I also needed to know that it was normal for a girl my age to become concerned with appearance based on biological drives, see chapter 18, and that these concerns would only be transitory. More importantly, I needed to know that restrictive dieting wasn't the answer and would only make things worse. I needed to know that regardless of how I felt about my body, I had to avoid restrictive dieting to avoid dangerous consequences. Just like I learned that, regardless of how much I wanted to fit in, I had to avoid smoking to avoid dangerous consequences. I also needed to understand and appreciate that eating is for health, not weight. I'm not saying I shouldn't have changed any of my eating habits at the time. I simply should not have turned to dieting. There would have been nothing wrong with me cutting back on soda and some other unhealthy foods in my diet in the name of health, replacing those empty calories with truly nourishing foods. But I did not do this. I cut back on my food purely in the name of weight loss. I wish I knew then what I know now. Skipping meals and depriving the body of nourishment in order to lose weight is a dangerous choice and simply doesn't work for weight control in the long run. Perhaps this important message can help others avoid turning to restrictive dieting. Chapter 40. Bridges to Traditional Therapy. The primary message of this book is that in order to recover from bulimia or BED, one has to stop binge eating. It may seem overly simplistic, but it is the truth, even from the perspective of traditional therapy. All paths to complete recovery inevitably involve quitting binge eating, regardless of how long that takes. Since quitting binge eating changes the brain, it follows that all paths to recovery ultimately lead to desirable brain changes. Traditional therapy can work for some people by ceasing binge eating and preventing it from ever coming back. In these cases, the brain is already undergoing or has already undergone the necessary changes. My mission in this book is not to take away what is already working or has already worked for other people. Like I've said, some binge eaters indeed recover using traditional therapy. So I'm just trying to offer an alternative for when therapy isn't working, isn't resonating, isn't effective, and isn't possible or desired. I don't think my ideas are altogether antithetical to those of traditional therapy. On the contrary, in some ways my brain over binge approach might be compatible with each major therapeutic approach as discussed below. A bridge to psychodynamic therapy. With this form of therapy, it is most difficult to build a bridge. Yet I see two ways in which psychodynamic therapy and brain over binge could be used together. First, I have been told by a few critics that my basic argument is simply to stop the behavior first, then work on underlying issues. Actually, this is not what I'm saying, because this still contains the potentially harmful idea that the eating disorder and the other problems are intimately related, and solving the other problems is necessary for full recovery and relapse prevention. I believe that once the BED or bulimia is stopped, any personal improvements made are only quality of life improvements, unrelated to recovery. Even though stop the behavior first, then work on underlying issues is not the message of this book, I do believe that is the most useful order of events when psychodynamic therapy is employed. Psychodynamic therapy could be presented in conjunction with brain over binge, such that the binging could stop first, then the emotional changes could occur afterward. This would avoid binge eaters getting the message that they can stop only once they resolve this or that issue or become whole or happy. Stopping the habit first would have the added advantage of weeding out any problems that are actually result of the bulimia, meaning that lots of time and money wouldn't have to be wasted in therapy talking about side effects that would just go away when the habit disappears. Also, there is no reason that a patient can't solve emotional problems or underlying issues while she simultaneously stops the binge eating, as long as the two endeavors are kept separate. Secondly, psychodynamic therapy could be used as readiness therapy. Recall my belief that the first step in recovery is wanting to recover. This book is intended for people who fully realize they have a problem and want to recover from it, or at least part of them wants to recover. However, I'm sure there are binge eaters out there who do not feel any pull toward recovery, who are complacent in their behavior, who don't have any desire to give it up. Without the will for recovery, the separation between the self and the binge-created brain wiring problem is irrelevant. Being driven by the lower brain will remain the status quo. The highest human brain has to be on board with recovery, even though the lower brain will resist. Psychodynamic therapy could then be used to help find a spark of the true self who wants to recover. I'm not talking about finding the true self in the sense of becoming fulfilled and developing a cohesive identity prior to stop binge eating, because this could put off recovery for a very long time. I'm talking about using psychodynamic therapy as a way to catch a glimpse of the highest human brain that does not want to be run down by the lower brain any longer. In summary, a patient doesn't have to transform in psychodynamic therapy in order to recover, but she can use it to transform afterward if the transformation is desired, just like anyone else, with or without bulimia, could use this type of therapy. Alternatively, psychodynamic therapy could be the vehicle that helps a patient find the part of herself that wants to recover. Bridge to cognitive behavioral therapy. Cognitive behavioral therapy is the easiest to build a bridge toward, because on the surface, it doesn't seem that much different from the brain over binge approach. The ultimate goal in CBT is to substitute healthy behaviors for binge eating. In substituting healthy behaviors for unhealthy ones, CBT activates executive systems, the prefrontal cortex, and can develop new neural pathways that support substitute behaviors. Isn't this similar to what I've been talking about? Ideally, it could be. If the bulimic goes for a walk, takes a warm bath, sews, or does another fulfilling or distracting activity every time the urge to binge hits, then yes, the neural pathways that support those new behaviors would become strong, and the pathways that support binge eating would weaken. However, CBT, at least for me, made it so that I could rarely substitute one of those positive behaviors. I had lists upon lists of things to do instead of binge, but actually doing the things on those lists was overwhelming. It was so difficult because of the value CBT placed on my urges. My urges to binge were supposedly the result of something significant, like a stressor, a trigger, or an emotion I supposedly couldn't cope with. I gave the urges attention and emotional significance in trying to decipher them, which only made them more powerful. Furthermore, I thought that substituting a healthy coping skill or distracting activity was supposed to take away or significantly lessen my desire to binge, which of course it didn't. I couldn't resist my urges as long as they had any measure of value, physical or emotional. It was only when I learned to view them as neurological junk that I was able to resist. When I did stop acting on my urges, I didn't necessarily substitute positive activities for them, mainly because that's what I tried to do in vain for many years, and I wanted to do something different. That said, I could have substituted specific positive behaviors. This is where the bridge to CBT lies. If you are using CBT, you may find that a change of perspective regarding your urges allows you to easily choose alternative activities over binges. Once you stop giving your urges attention and attaching meaning to them, you will have the power to assert your will and substitute any positive behavior you want. In the OCD study I have repeatedly discussed, the majority of Schwartz's patients were able to engage in alternative activities, such as gardening, instead of acting on OCD urges. He found that his patients' ability to perform those substitute behaviors was related to the value they placed on their urges. In fact, the key predictor of whether his therapy would help an OCD patient was whether he learns to recognize that a pathological urge to perform a compulsive behavior reflects a faulty brain message, in other words, to revalue it. Revaluing was the step where he taught his patients to quickly recognize the disturbing thoughts as senseless, as false, as errant brain signals, not even worth the gray matter they wrote on, let alone worth acting on. The more detached the patients were from their urges, the less significance they placed on them, the greater their ability to focus their intention on an alternative activity. Based on my premise that the urge to binge is the only true cause of binge eating, if the bulimic learns to view the urge differently, as simple junk from the lower brain, it doesn't have to cause binge eating. If CBT added this simple concept to the vast array of cognitive and behavioral techniques it endorses, then I believe those techniques could become doable for many. Separation and attachment from the urge can make doing any number of alternate activities possible, even if it's simply something distracting, like surfing the internet, doing a crossword puzzle, or listening to music. In other words, brain over binge could give patients the willpower they need to use CBT-recommended techniques, and therefore make CBT a more effective therapy. It's a subtle change in the approach, but it could make a world of difference for many. CBT is also useful in changing cognitive distortions regarding weight and body shape. If a woman is determined to diet restrictively when she stops binge eating, then her urges to binge probably won't go away quickly or at all. CBT could help her give up the desire to deprive herself by helping her think healthier thoughts about food and weight, or by providing nutritional counseling. This is useful to women and men with or without a history of an eating disorder, place an unhealthy value on their weight and appearance. Furthermore, CBT can help correct thoughts that lead to depression, anxiety, perfectionism, or negative feelings. Again, useful for anyone with or without an eating disorder who suffers from those problems. As long as recovery doesn't hinge on solving any coexisting problems, CBT is useful in solving a wide variety of them. Bridge to addiction therapy. If you believe you are addicted to certain foods, especially sugar and carbohydrates, then you are probably right. But we don't actually experience a true loss of control when we eat those foods. Like I've said, the loss of control in binge eating is only a perceived loss of control, not a biologically based loss of control. What we don't have control over is the surfacing of our urges to binge. If the lower brain is conditioned to binge on certain problematic foods, like sugary ones, then even one bite of something sugary will automatically produce an urge to binge. It's these urges to binge that we have no control over, not the actual binge eating. Knowing this, a binge eater could use the addiction model in this way. She could avoid all problematic foods for a while if she wants, knowing that she will probably crave them and knowing she can detach herself from these cravings. Then she could gradually introduce them in moderate amounts, That is, if she wants them to be part of her normal diet. When reintroducing the foods, she should set a limit and stick to it. But she should know that the brain will send urges to eat much more than the set limit. For example, if a limit of 4 cookies is set, eating those 4 cookies will probably set her lower brain aflame with desire for the whole box. But if, using her highest human brain, she remains separate and detached from this automatic brain reaction and assigns it no value, she should be able to refrain from reacting to the urges and acting on them. Once normal amounts of problematic foods are eaten many times, the old binge eating habit will subside, and eating moderate portions will become normal and effortless. Or, if she doesn't want to eat any amounts of former problematic foods, perhaps for health reasons, there is no pressing reason to, as long as she knows how to deal with her urges to binge when she inevitably eats those problematic foods someday. It seems unrealistic to expect that everyone will never eat even a bit of sugar for the rest of their life, so it's vital to be prepared for when we do eat a problem food. Prepared only means being aware of the brain and dismissing any faulty messages it may send. Overeaters Anonymous. Overeaters Anonymous is a 12-step program that applies the addiction model to eating disorders. Although not all OA groups advocate complete abstinence from problem foods, all groups do advocate a plan of eating but maintain no specific requirements for that personal plan. Since OA is the most popular group using the addiction model, I will compare it briefly to the brain over binge model and suggest a different view of the first 3 steps of OA. Step 1. We admitted that we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step 2. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step 3. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. The rest of the 12 steps involve admitting wrongdoings and shortcomings, making amends with others, and ultimately, having a spiritual awakening and carrying the message to others, worthy life goals that don't have much to do with recovery from the actual eating disorder. In looking at the first 3 steps, I realized that I could reword them to describe my own recovery. Step 1. I admitted that I was powerless against the surfacing of my urges to binge in my lower brain and that I had stopped managing my own life. Step 2. I came to believe that I had great power within myself, my highest human brain, and that I could use that power to restore myself to sanity. Step 3. I made a decision to use my highest human brain to exert my free will over my urges, and I took my life back. The difference in my steps and OA steps is self-reliance. I used my own power, my own brain, my own free will to stop binge eating, without relying on anything or anyone else to do it for me. I am not suggesting that binge eaters cut God, as they understand Him, out of their recovery, because religious belief, prayer, and spirituality give many people strength in all facets of life. However, if reliance on God, or any other power outside of oneself, does not enable cessation of the destructive behavior, then it is time to change perspective and take full responsibility for quitting. There is nothing magical about making amends with other people and having a spiritual awakening that will turn off automatic urges in the brain. I believe binge eaters have to do that on their own through refusing to act on each and every urge. Redefining higher power to mean the highest human brain could lead many in OA toward a more practical solution to binge eating. A change of perspective. In trying to build a bridge between the traditional therapeutic approaches and my brain-over-binge approach, I've argued that a change in perspective is possibly all that's needed for those whom therapy fails. In its simplest terms, this change of perspective includes separating the binge eating from life's other problems, learning to view urges to binge as valueless neurological junk, and using the capacity of the highest human brain to resist them. Perhaps these 3 changes could make any form of therapy more effective. I think many people in therapy make the same mistake I did in thinking the therapists, therapeutic techniques, or any number of life changes or character improvements will make quitting effortless, will somehow take away the desire to binge. Who knows? Maybe there is someone or something out there that can completely take away urges to binge. Maybe if a binge eater continues therapy for many years, keeps talking about her problems, tries different medications, works hard on improving her self-esteem and anxiety, and deals with every possible underlying issue, the urges to binge will go away. But why leave it to chance? Urges will assuredly go away if the binge eater stops binge eating. So why not stop it now? Since any path to recovery eventually and essentially involves a cessation of binge eating, why put it off any longer? To feel the urges to binge and not act on them is the most direct path of a full recovery. It trains the brain to undo the habit right then and there and gradually puts a stop to the urges. It is also a foolproof protection against relapse because if one never acts on an urge to binge, one can never relapse. If such a simple solution is available, why would anyone want to wait around for months or years for the urges to possibly go away? There is no reason to stop therapy if therapy is serving a useful purpose, as long as the binge eater changes her perspective surrounding the urges to binge and stops acting on them. Chapter 41. Conclusion. Fulfilling some need. My binge eating certainly did fulfill needs, but not the complex emotional needs that my therapist spoke of. It fulfilled the needs of my survival drives. Then it fulfilled my lower brain's need to maintain the very habit it started. If only someone had told me bulimia was a simple brain problem from the moment I entered therapy, I could have easily fixed it. This is now my mission, to be that someone who tells other binge eaters that a simple and quick recovery is possible without therapy. If you are bulimic, or if you suffer from binge eating disorder, or if you binge only occasionally, I want to tell you that there is nothing wrong with you. You have only temporarily become a victim of your own healthy brain. If you are confused by therapy and not finding help there, I want to tell you that I believe there is a more direct and more cost-effective way to stop your behavior. I want to tell you that you can learn to view your binge eating differently, not as a symptom of underlying emotional issues, but as a symptom of something very real and concrete going on in your brain. I want to tell you that change is much easier if you dismiss the beliefs that you binge for deeper, more profound reasons, and instead learn how your lower brain works to keep you binge eating. I want to tell you that you have the power to take control of your actions, overcome your habit, and escape the daily torment binge eating brings. The bottom line is, in order to recover from bulimia, or stop any other habit for that matter, you have to stop the behavior. It is the simple and difficult truth. My own experience leads me to believe it is possible to quit on your own, even right now, without undergoing a major character transformation, without spending thousands of dollars on therapists or treatment centers, without stopping your life, and without having to deal with your eating disorder every day for the rest of your life. I truly believe that if I did it, anyone can, because believe me, there is nothing special about me, and yet I was able to change my brain to erase any desire to binge eat. Repeating the same old destructive behavior is not only a problem of bulimics, binge eaters, and other addicts. It's a problem shared by the whole human race. We humans are the lucky ones, though, because we do not have to follow every impulse from our brains. We can observe our own thoughts and feelings, and from moment to moment, we can choose which ones we will follow through on and which ones we will disregard. Our marvelous, highest human brains give us great responsibility. We have the ability to write our brain's own programs by what we repeatedly do. This means that our actions carry much weight. Each day, we can choose to act in ways that are consistent with our goals and identities, or we can make poor choices and let bad habits take hold. What we do will affect our futures in a very real and physical way by altering the neural footprints